Imagine this. All the NFL owners anxiously standing around awaiting their turn to select a specially marked paper from a hat, which would entitle one of them to take home the first overall pick in the upcoming draft. In 1947, Commissioner Burt Bell did just that, implementing what would effectively be an NFL version of the draft lottery. The idea was to provide each of the then 10 NFL teams, regardless of record, the opportunity to make what was referred to as the bonus pick. It was only one a year, and when a team won, it wasn't eligible to enter the drawing the following year. In this way, each team would be afforded the privilege. The bonus pick system started in 1947 with the Chicago Bears selecting back Bob Fenimore of Oklahoma A&M, and ended in 1958 with quarterback King Hill of Rice being tapped by the Chicago Cardinals. Like the first picks of today, not all the selectees became stars. Bob Fenimore, selected by the Bears, played only the 47 season. And Harry Babcock of Georgia was taken by San Francisco in 1953 and only played sparingly from 53 to 55. And quarterback Robert Garrett of Stanford, picked by Cleveland in 1954, played only that season with Green Bay. Still, it doesn't take a genius to figure out why it didn't last. In 1951, the 10-2 Giants landed the bonus pick. They chose the best halfback in the country, Kyle Rhode of SMU. By 1958, all the teams had been given the opportunity once, and Burt Bell's bonus pick gimmick was retired. Today we feature three stories from football's past that didn't quite work out as planned, including, and I'm not making this up, a choose-your-own-adventure football game, live, a numbering system so easy its creator said even a woman could understand it, and the biggest accidental waiver steal of all time. For the National Football Post, along with the Professional Football Researchers Association, I'm your host, Eric Oler. Welcome to Throwbacks. Part 1. Waiver Misbehavior.
Considering the big money teams shell out for their star quarterbacks today, it's hard to believe that in the 1960s, one team picked up an all-star for a mere $100 because a Hall of Fame coach misunderstood a new wrinkle in the AFL's waiver rule. But it happened, and the deal changed the course of AFL history. The quarterback in question was Jack Kemp, who had led the Chargers to the AFL title game in each of the league's first two seasons, earning all AFL recognition in 1960 and making the All-League second team in 1961. Though they had lost both championship games, San Diego was the preseason favorite to win a third straight Western Division title in 1962. But the Chargers opened the season with a disappointing loss to Denver. They followed that with a costly 40-14 victory over the New York Titans, in which Kemp and his backup, rookie John Hadle, were both injured. A couple of days later, it was revealed that Kemp had a broken finger, but he put on his game face and insisted he'd be able to play on Sunday since the Chargers' third QB was another untested rookie named Dick Wood. Gilman delayed making a decision on his starter as long as he could. By the weekend, though, it became clear that Kemp just wasn't able to go, and wouldn't be for quite some time. Gilman didn't want an unavailable player taking up a spot on his 33-man roster, so he moved Kemp to injured deferred status, essentially what we call injured reserve today. To do so, he first had to put Kemp on waivers, at which point any team in the league could claim him for $100, and Buffalo did. Every book reports this as a risky move by Gilman that backfired. But that's not the case. It seems Gilman expected that if a team tried to claim Kemp, he could just be taken off the waiver wire and the Chargers would simply be forced to keep him on their active roster. And if he hadn't waited so long to make a decision about Kemp, that's exactly what would have happened. But the AFL had a new rule that anyone placed on waivers on Saturday or Sunday couldn't be recalled if claimed by another team, a rule of which Gilman was apparently unaware. Gilman himself contributed to the confusion, describing the loss of Kemp not as a mistake, but as a calculated risk that didn't pan out. That's how the San Diego Union reported it on September 26, 1962, a day after the deal was announced. But it seems clear that the coach was simply trying to put a positive spin on what amounted to a dumb mistake. Before long, he was talking as if he had simply released his starting quarterback, saying he didn't believe the Chargers could win consistently with Kemp and that the passing offense has been questionable for a year and a half. He really committed to the bit, even citing three delay-of-game penalties called during the Denver game because of Kemp's indecision, and said even one such penalty was unacceptable. And he touched on a real sore spot when he said that with better passing in either title game, we would have won. The latter claim certainly had some merit. In the two championship games, both against the Oilers, Kemp had completed 38 of 73 passes for only 397 yards and no touchdowns, with six interceptions. The lack of offense was especially costly in the second game, in which the Chargers picked off five George Blanda passes but failed to take advantage in a 10-3 loss. But since the team had posted regular season records of 10-4 and 12-2, the idea that they couldn't win consistently with Kemp seems absurd. It's also true that Kemp had played poorly in the first two games of 1962, completing only 13 of 45 passes. And with star running back Paul Lowe out for the season, there would be more pressure than ever on the Chargers' passing attack. Still, consider this. One of the major concerns in San Diego was the lack of a top-notch center. And just a few weeks earlier, the Raiders, who had lost QB Tom Flores for the season, had offered to trade Jim Otto for Kemp. If Gilman really believed Kemp couldn't cut it as the Chargers' quarterback, would he have turned down a deal for the AFL's best center? Of course not! In any case, the Chargers stumbled through a 4-10 season in 1962 with Hadel and Wood calling the signals. And afterward, Gilman was convinced he needed a veteran quarterback to handle the job until Hadel was ready to be a starter. In the offseason, he acquired Tobin Rote, a former NFL star who had been playing in Canada for the past 3 years. The move was a complete success. Rote led the AFL in passing, and the Chargers won the championship in convincing fashion, routing the Boston Patriots 51-10 in the title game. San Diego made it back to the championship game in 1964, as Hadel gradually took over the starting QB job, and again a year later, with Rote now gone and Hadel in complete command. But the Chargers were trounced each year by the AFL's new powerhouse team, the Buffalo Bills, led by none other than Jack Kemp. The Bills made one more trip to the championship game in 1966, losing to Kansas City, and faded after that. But not before Kemp had refuted Gilman's charge that a team couldn't win consistently with him at the helm. The acquisition of Kemp turned the Bills into a mini-dynasty. But to be honest, even though the whole situation was embarrassing for Gilman, you can't say it was terribly costly, since the Chargers did pretty well without Kemp from 1963 to 65. And the team's subsequent fall from title contention wasn't the fault of Hadel, who was a fine quarterback well into the 1970s. In the long run, even Oakland, the team that had wanted Kemp badly enough to offer Jim Otto for him, benefited indirectly from Buffalo's coup. After the 1966 season, frustrated by back-to-back second-place finishes, the Raiders traded for a quarterback named Daryl LaMonica, gave him their starting job, and compiled a regular season record of 37-4-1 over the last 3 years of the AFL, as LaMonica was twice named the league's MVP. Why was such a quality quarterback available? Because he was considered expendable by his former team, the Buffalo Bills, who didn't need him because they had Jack Kemp. So many people laying in the skinny yards. Every time I approach them to my heart. And the only thing I need, and the only thing I wish, I don't know what happened with my fucking bony hands. Everything.
Part 2. R2-D2.
Jim Schneider had an idea. He was a Pittsburgh businessman who, in 1973, at the age of 52, came up with a different method for numbering football uniforms. Since then, he probably wished he'd just tried to build a better mousetrap. What Schneider hoped to do was make fan identification of players quicker, easier, and more informative. Toward that end, he devised a new system of uniform numbering, one he believed would give the fan instant recognition of every player on the field without need of a program. Schneider's idea was simple. Instead of using the traditional two-digit numbers, he proposed using a letter and a single number to identify players. Under Schneider's system, every offensive player would have been assigned an odd number, every defensive player an even number. The position would be coded by a letter: Q for quarterback, T for tackle, G for guard, L for linebacker, etc. Terry Bradshaw, then, to pick a name purely at random, would have Q3 on his uniform and helmet. Lynn Swan would be W1, John Stallworth, W3, and Jack Lambert, L4. Schneider agreed that college squads, with their larger registers, would make two-digit numbers necessary. "I thought this would be so much easier for fan identification," said Schneider, "especially for the games on television and for women who don't watch football all the time and don't know the players all that well." With the claim that his system would also be a boon to better officiating, Schneider added, "Every time I've shown this idea to my friends, they say, 'Hey Jim, you've really got something there,' and I just know it will work." But unfortunately for Schneider, no one in the National Football League, the Canadian Football League, the NCAA, or even high school athletic associations agreed. Schneider wrote and contacted various spokesmen in each of these organizations, once even offering to buy a grade school team's uniforms if they bore his letters and numbers, only to receive a polite no thanks. "Your system is interesting, and we appreciate your interest in devising such a plan for consideration by the league," wrote Jim Boston, the Steelers' business manager, in a letter to Schneider in 1973. "Maybe at some future date there will be a new plan adopted, and possibly it will be your own plan." But even if Schneider hadn't been able to get off the schneid with football people, the frustration was small compared to that caused by his warfare with the U.S. Patent Office, which began with his first application in 1974. In repetitive attempts to prove that his football code satisfied the four tests necessary for a patent, that it is useful, novel, of non-obvious difference to one of ordinary skill in the art, and that it is a machine, manufacture, composition, or method, Schneider accumulated a 1¾-pound stack of legal correspondence, government fees, and a long siege of bewilderment. Each time the patent office denied Schneider's application, the occasion was marked by a bale of documents. Baffling, semi-legible, incomprehensible, Xeroxed, catch-22, each apparently relating to Schneider's idea for football as apple pie does to a surfboard. Offered by the patent examiner as proof that Schneider's football number code doesn't satisfy the four tests, the evidence included a variety of previous patent applications, diagrams, and product illustrations. Among other documents, they include 1 entirely written in French, 7 dealing with board games that appear to be new versions of chess, checkers, and bingo, 1 for an all-purpose heated athletic bench called the Jenkins Hot Seat, 1 dated in 1897, a picture of the sideline kicking net used by Pat Studstill when he punted for the Los Angeles Rams, a totally unreadable copy of a magazine article about different colored pants for each football position. It should come as no great surprise, then, to know it took Schneider until 1979 to get the patent office to recognize that his idea applied to human football rather than a simulated board game. And he might have dropped the whole idea but for the announced birth of the USFL in 1982. Schneider, as you might expect, had renewed hope. Some dreams continue, even through a nightmare.
I want to take a moment to thank the organization that makes this podcast possible. The Pro Football Researchers Association has been publishing stories like the ones you're hearing today in their newsletter, The Coffin Corner, since 1979. If you like the history of football, you need to join. Membership's only $35 annually. It gets you access to their newsletter as well as a ton of great stuff on their website, including game books, oral history, voting rights for their Hall of Very Good, and one of the most complete collections of football knowledge anywhere on the internet. For more info on membership, contact them at pfra@profootballresearchers.org or visit them on the web at profootballresearchers.org. Now back to our show. Part 3, Forced to Punt. Columbus, Ohio is best known for the Buckeyes, but Columbus also has a long football tradition on semi-professional and professional fields. Since 1900, 15 teams have attempted to share in the Ohio State-generated enthusiasm for football. One of the more recent was the Columbus Metros, founded in 1978. The Metros were billed as the 29th best team in America, and even rose to number one in the coveted Pro Football Weekly national rankings. But their league, the Midwest Football League, was a mess. No one was showing up to the games. They won some on account of forfeit when the other team couldn't schedule a field to play on. In the 1978 Midwest League semifinal game, they were scheduled to play Lansing. On Wednesday of the week before the Saturday night game, Lansing officials called the Metros to inform them that most of the team had quit. Unsure of what to do, especially considering this would be the Metros' final 1978 game in the $1,400 a night, 15,000-seat Franklin County Stadium, and that the game was to be played for a local charity, Metros officials insisted that the Lansing bring whoever they could. A Lansing team of less than 15 players, well below the Midwest League's 25-player minimum, walked onto the field at 7:35 p.m., 5 minutes after the scheduled kickoff. Intent on avoiding embarrassment and financial loss because of a game cancellation, four Metros players, several trainers, and even several fans were secretly enlisted for the Lansing roster. When the news media discovered the scam, the Metros public relations firm reported that while some dressed in Lansing uniforms, no Metros players actually participated in the game for Lansing. In fact, several did. Columbus defeated the Metros/Capitals 50-7. ''1979 was much of the same. Poor attendance, cash burn, but a product that the owners believed in enough to try one more time. Staggering financially, the Metros organization pinned its hope of survival in 1980 on what has been called the most unique sports idea ever conceived, much less carried out. With most of the original organizers gone, the Metros entered into an off-season agreement with a Columbus cable television system, Warner Amex Cube, to play a televised game for $2,500 and a $2,500 winner-take-all purse against the Racine, Wisconsin Gladiators of the NSFL in Columbus, July 12th. The unique element would be that Cube's home viewers, using the cable system's interactive television push-button consoles, would direct the Metro's offense and defense against the Racine coaching staff. The home viewers, given several options designed in respect to field position and game situation, would push their play selection, with the plurality's choice being relayed to the players on the field. Your Call Football was a disaster. A severe thunderstorm washed away Franklin County Stadium's synthetic surface markings and much of the stadium crowd. It marked the third time in 3 years that the Metros began their home season in a cloudburst. After a long delay, play began with the Metros scoring first on a first-quarter end-around by Cornelius Green. However, the Metros' armchair coaches weren't able to continue their early success. Racine dominated the rest of the game and won 10-7. I looked in every dark corner of the internet for anything close to as revolutionary an idea as this. The closest I came was the 1996 Whoopi Goldberg movie Eddie, where Whoopi goes from cab driver to coach of the Knicks and turns the season around. But I think it's time we bring Your Call Football back. The technology's definitely there if it was possible in 1980, and it would make my Sundays watching the Bills a lot more tolerable. We'll be right back. Special thanks today to my narrators, Eric Young and Gregory Deal. Waiver Misbehavior was written by Bob Gill and appeared in a 2000 edition of The Coffin Corner. Our second story appeared in its original form in the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette in 1982 and was written by Ron Reed. For more Throwbacks podcasts, along with a list of the music you heard today, head to nationalfootballpost.com and click on the football history banners. There you'll also find some great interviews by Ken Kripen with some of football's greatest names in his Where Are They Now series. If you're interested in scouting, working in football, or just becoming a better fan, National Football Post is now accepting enrollment for its Introduction to Scouting class. It begins in February. It's taught by our own Greg Gabriel. You do not want to miss it. For more info, head to nfpscout.com. If you use the promo code THROWBACKS, you'll receive an additional $50 off your tuition. My thanks again to the Pro Football Researchers Association. Please visit them at profootballresearchers.org, where you can find printed versions of the stories just like the ones you heard today. If you like what you heard today, please tweet it, like it, share it, get it out there. Leave us a good review on iTunes. If you'd like to contribute to the show, contact us at information@nationalfootballpost.com. We'll be back soon with more stories from football's past. For National Football Post and the Pro Football Researchers Association, I'm your host, Eric Oler. Thank you for listening to Throwbacks.